Today's program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Jackie Berger, and you're listening to Just Food Stories, airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. If you missed the live broadcast, you can always find us archived at heritageradionetwork.org or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just Food is a nonprofit organization committed to helping people build community food projects. We know that people all over New York City know that we need to change our food system, and they want to make that change. But so often, people don't even know where to start. So we'd like to take the next half hour to introduce you to someone who has started taking her passions and skills to bring change. Hopefully, her story will inspire you to create your own Just Food story. So I'm on. I have... On the line, I have Michaela Hayes. Michaela, are you there?
I'm here, Jackie. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you great. Thanks so much. Michaela is a wonderful person. She works so hard to help people preserve the seasons and eat locally throughout the year, and she does that in many different ways. She does that because she founded a company called Crock and Jar, where she's preserving the food and making that available. And she's teaching people all over the city and much further afield to do a fermentation and preservation, and so that they can do that for themselves and preserve their own harvest. She also has, she's been an educator. She also developed the pickling station while she was at Gramercy Tavern. So we definitely want to chat about that. And you can find out what she's up to all the time because she's writing One for the Season for Sweet Paul Magazine, and she runs the NYC Ferments Meetup Group. Michaela, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Really happy to have you on the line. So, Michaela, let's start with some basics for folks that maybe are a little unclear, because, you know, I know that canning has become a really big kind of fad trend. Hopefully it's like an emerging wave where people will realize how easy it is and really re-embrace this, you know, what was recently a dying art. But there's such a big difference between canning and fermenting, and I know that you do both. Can you talk a little bit about, like, you know, the beginner's level of, like, what the difference is between those two practices?
Sure. So canning is basically how I started on the food preservation path through becoming a Just Food trainer. So I always like to give a shout-out to Just Food as helping me to get started, too.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And canning is, so I started doing canning when I became a Just Food trainer. I was cooking in restaurants, like you mentioned. I was cooking at Gramercy Tavern, and because I was doing so much cooking, I didn't necessarily want to teach cooking, but canning was a little bit different enough for me that it really piqued my interest. And it is also, for me, a perfect combination, I always tell people, of food, art, and science. And the thing about canning that is, the main thing about canning that is different than fermentation is that you have to be a lot more careful, because you're dealing with a process that can be very dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And you do have to worry about, dangerous bacteria like botulism. When we're talking about fermentation, it is not an issue. Fermentation is not a process. At least when we're talking about fruit and vegetable fermentation, meat is a little different. But for fruits and vegetables, fermentation is a very, very safe process.
Really?
Yeah.
It's, and actually, you know, go ahead. Well, it's so interesting because, I think about canning and, like, the hot water bath process, and then you have these cans and the lids are sealed and you hear that pop. And then, you know, that feels so scientific and correct, whereas what what is like the big leap, I think, for folks to go into fermentation is it feels so much less conclusive. It feels so much more, I mean, I'm trying to think of a word other than organic, but like the process doesn't feel as scientific in a way. I'm sure, I mean, it is more scientific probably, but...
But, well, they're equally scientific, but I get what you're saying about the canning. I think part of the thing about canning is because it has the potential to be a more dangerous process. I mean, it's very easy to do very safely. And when I teach canning, that is one of the things that I stress to people. Like, canning is super easy to do super safely as long as you know where the sort of the critical points are that are helping you to keep that process safe. And basically with canning, that's acidity. For fermentation, because you don't have to worry as much maybe about it being like safe, there isn't necessarily that strict process. And one of the books that I recommend to people who are starting out with fermentation is Wild Fermentation by Sandra Katz.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that title for the book because it's sort of, I mean, you were looking for another word for organic when you were talking about fermentation. Mm-hmm. And for me, wild is kind of that word.
Right. Because he's not talking about like wild and crazy wild. Right?
Well, I mean, a little bit.
A little
yes.
bit.
I mean, he's talking about harvesting wild cultures. So, like bacteria that exist in the air everywhere in the whole world, and you can basically start a fermentation process just by creating an environment that is beneficial to those bacteria. But also, the thing about fermentation is that it's a little bit loosey-goosey, you know, I mean, you can add a little more salt or a little less salt, and it's still going to ferment and be something that is slightly different than, you know, my something is slightly different than your something. And the other thing that I think is wonderful about fermentation is that, like when people talk about wine, which is also a fermented beverage.
What was that?
They talk wine.
Oh, wine, right. Wine, yes. Right. Wine. Familiar with wine.
When people talk about wine, they talk about terroir.
Mm-hmm.
So where the grapes were grown, the soil, all the ingredients in the air and the climate that make up that specific flavor of that wine. So when we're talking about fermentation, lactofermentation with vegetables and everything, I like to talk about like the terroir in my kitchen. Is it going to be different than the terroir in your kitchen and in somebody else's kitchen entirely? You know, we all have different things and different, you know, we all have different things going on in our homes, in our spaces, you know, if we're on a farm or wherever. And one of the examples that I like to give is when my wife and I were living out in Santa Cruz, she was going through an agroecology program out there. And this group of about 30 apprentices shared a kitchen space, a farm center kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And the terroir in that kitchen, after decades of farm apprentices being in there, having all these different fermentation projects going on, tempeh and sourdough and, you know, kimchi and canning and all kinds of preservation things going on, it was phenomenal. I mean, we fermented ginger beer in our house before we moved out there, and then we started fermenting it out there, and it was, like, super ginger beer.
Really? So is there anything that, like, for home cooks who don't have the advantage of moving into a kitchen where people have been working at fermentation projects for decades, is there anything that we can do or that you do at home to kind of cultivate a stronger terroir for fermentation in your home?
Well, what I tell people in my classes is that when I do this on a commercial scale, so I operate out of a commercial kitchen, and I've worked in two different commercial kitchens for my product, for Crock and Jar products at this point. And I'll often go into new vessels, you know, when I'm expanding, like, okay, I have a new flavor, I need to get new buckets to ferment it in.
Uh-huh.
And so when I start with a new vessel, it will ferment a little differently the first time than it will the second time. Like the second time, it'll just go a little more smoothly because I've already started cultivating that bacteria. So what I tell people basically is once you start kind of cultivating these types of bacteria, they're just, I mean, you're building an environment where they're living, like they live around my kitchen.
So all you can do is do more.
In many different ways.
Right. So the more you ferment, the better you get at it, not just because of experience, but because you're actually creating a better environment for those bacteria to do their thing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that's what I think. And with the caveat, I will say, of different kinds of fermentation are not necessarily beneficial in the same location. So, for example, if I was fermenting my own vinegar, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to have that anywhere near any kind of wine that I was making.
Oh, right. Have you heard about people making that mistake?
I haven't, but when I was working at Gramercy Tavern and doing a lot of pickling there, and, you know, we created this pickling position in the kitchen, I would ferment. I used the wine room for a lot of my fermentation, and that was a concern initially, was whether this lacto-fermentation would be potentially damaging to, you know, thousands of dollars worth of wine inventory in the wine room.
And why did you guys decide to go ahead and do that anyway? Was it, did you protect the wine?
They're different processes, mm-hmm. basically. So lacto-fermentation is cultivating a different sort of bacteria that theoretically is not going to interfere with the wine. I did just speak with someone recently who makes beer in his home, and he was worried a little bit about lacto-fermentation in proximity to the beer, which is something that I need to do more research about. But mm-hmm. he was saying that, you know, some people want a beer that has a little more sourness to it, mm. but other beers you want to keep that, the lactic acid bacteria, you want to keep it away from the beers. So, but in the case of wine and vinegar, like, those are bacteria that are feeding off of the vinegar, at least. It's feeding off of alcohol. So obviously wine is alcohol, so you wouldn't want vinegar bacteria in proximity to the wine.
Okay. So provided we're not also making wine or brewing in our homes. I mean, when I look at your website, and it's crockandjar.com, and, you know, if you're listening right now, I think you should browse this because you'll start salivating. There's just beautiful foods on your website, and a lot of them are fermented foods. What do you feel like? And Michaela, I just want to put in a plug, because on April 5th, you're going to be doing a full day intensive on fermentation for the Just Food Conference. And I think that will be kind of a little bit more of an entry point for people who want to do fermentation. So what do you think of as the gateway fermentation processes that people can start with that are kind of manageable and kind of easy wins on the fermentation front?
I usually like to start people with sauerkraut, and I do call it the gateway ferment. So
good.
It's nice that you use that. sauerkraut is the products that I make. Sauerkraut-based ferments are the majority of them at this point. So one of the great things about cabbage is that when you're fermenting it, you could make sauerkraut with just cabbage and salt. Like, those are really the only ingredients that you need, because if you get good, juicy cabbage, it is going to, with the addition of salt, create its own brine.
Mm-hmm. So, wait, when you say good, juicy cabbage, like, is that, I mean, where do you get good, juicy cabbage?
From your local farmer!
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking, like, so many grocery store cabbages, like, the words good might be associated with it, maybe, but juicy, not really.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually tricky this time of year, because in the Northeast right now, we can usually get cabbage year-round if we're lucky and we don't have a hurricane. Mm-hmm. But at this point in the year, it is usually storage cabbage. It's
right.
Cabbage that people have picked and they're storing in cold storage. And some farmers are better at storing produce than others, so you may get cabbage that's a little bit drier or not. But if you get it fresh during, like if it's just been harvested and you're buying it at the farmer's market or getting it in your CSA, that should be like good juicy cabbage.
And so the minute you bring it home, I mean, when you think about preserving foods, you want to preserve food that you get like at the peak of, the food is at the peak of freshness, and then that's what you're, you know, preserving or tapping into when you do a preservation project, right?
Right. It's the, you know, it's the most local, it's the freshest picked, the most full of nutrients. It hasn't, you know, been sitting for a while, and it's going to be the most flavorful if you can get to it right away. So, the storage cabbage is still great and delicious and local, and if it's been stored well, is, you know, is still full of nutrients. But you are going to get different levels of that juiciness, just to keep using that word, if you get cabbage that's freshly picked versus stored.
Okay, well, we're going to let our listeners chew on the notion of juicy cabbage for just a couple minutes because we need to take a short break. But we'll be right back with Just Food Stories on heritageradionetwork.org, so stay with us. Just circles on the map. Just circles on the map. Yeah, cherry lemon on your back. Cherry on your back.
Today's music is by Cookies on heritageradionetwork.org.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome back. I'm Jackie Berger, and you're listening to Just Food Stories on heritageradionetwork.org. And we're here with Michaela Hayes, founder of Crock and Jar, educator and fermenter extraordinaire. And we're talking about juicy cabbage, among other things. So, Michaela, I think that the fact that you're using, you have these incredible skills and talents. You've clearly proven yourself in the field, and being able to pioneer a pickling station at Gramercy Tavern is such a such a cool project to have under your belt. But you spend a lot of time teaching people to do it. Why do you make that a priority?
Well, a couple of different reasons. So my main mission with creating the company is to support our local food economy, sort of our local food systems and my community. And what that means to me is that if we help support local farmers, that we have a more vibrant, sustainable food system, and we're also able to create more of, take more control of the food that we put in our bodies. So with the company, when I'm making product, like I can go out and buy 150 pounds of cabbage, you know, plus other vegetables at one go, mm-hmm. and that's great, and it will help support some local farmers. But if I go out and I teach a whole bunch of other people to, preserve food, and they go out and buy from their local farmers markets or join a CSA, then it just increases exponentially the amount of people and the ways that people are supporting our local food system.
I'm getting this mental picture in my head of people all over the city, like being in little clusters, learning this art, spreading out and creating these little points that they're doing this work in their own kitchen, and us all creating a better fermentation environment in New York City.
Yes.
It's this crusade to bring more good bacteria.
That's right.
Into the city. So for people who are thinking about getting started, is it expensive? Is there a lot of equipment? Like, what do they, and I know that you'll cover some of this in the course, but like, is there like a big hurdle people have to overcome in order to start either canning or fermenting?
No, there isn't. There's a little bit, maybe more for canning, but not even that much. For canning, you know, you need a big pot with a rack at the bottom, and I give people, I mean, I have a lot of kitchen supplies to the chagrin of my wife, but you don't need to have a lot of expensive equipment to do canning, and you need even less for fermentation. Basically, the tools that I list for people for fermentation is you need some kind of produce that you're going to ferment, you need salt, you need a container to put it in, some kind of weight, and we talk about different types of weights that you can use to weigh your produce down so that it's underneath the liquid. That's the main thing about fermentation, is that you want to keep your produce submerged while it's fermenting. Mm-hmm. And then you need a label, and that's another big thing that I stress in my class, because if you don't know when you started it, you don't know when it's done.
Well, I mean, are things, what affects the pace at which things are done? Is it like clockwork, or is there more of an art form to that?
There's definitely more of an art form to it, and a lot of it, and I tell people this in classes too, is your personal preference. So, like, I have my personal sweet spot for when something is sufficiently sour and still crunchy, and it may be very different from where your sweet spot is. So when I remember reading it
in his book or hearing it from him when he was giving a talk about how he was, you know, going around the country with his sauerkraut and kind of letting people do tastings of it. And somebody came up to him and was chewing it and chewing it and chewing it and saying, "This is great coleslaw."
Yes. Yeah.
Meaning not done, you know, like, so that, right, like, exactly, that whole sweet spot thing.
And I, you know, I've heard the same story, and I feel like I told it recently in a class, and it was, I think it was a woman from Austria, and so for her, it was, like, not even close to fermented enough.
Right.
So, and I tell people that in my class. I mean, I know people who ferment things for 3 days and put them in the refrigerator, and for some things, that might be done. For me, for sauerkraut, it's not, you know, it's definitely not close to my sweet spot. And I have other friends who don't even look at their ferments until they've been going for 6 weeks. So it, you know, there's a huge range in there.
So fermentation is, I think, great because for a lot of reasons. One is that it kind of allows you to hit pause on the harvest season. So, you know, if you're kind of, you're overwhelmed with your produce either at the market or if you go a little wild at the market, or you're overwhelmed with your CSA share and you have like something that you can ferment, you can kind of put that aside and without refrigeration really store it for a long time. So it really allows you to like make the most of the harvest season, hit pause on the harvest season. But the other thing I really like about it is, I don't know why, but fermentation seems to help people build community. You're organizing a meetup that's all about fermentation. What is it that you think about fermentation that makes people come out of their houses to do this together?
I mean, for me, again, like, it's that combination of food, art, and science. So I love the science side of it, and I tap into that a little bit in my classes too. But it is an art form. I mean, you can get so creative with an infinite number of combinations of, you know, food fermentation possibilities. I think, you know, food is one of the places where we naturally all come together. Like, we all have to eat. And why not make it a joyous occasion? And I think another thing about fermentation is that it is, well, a bunch of different things. I mean, I ask people in my classes, like, why do we ferment foods? And I kind of give 5 different reasons. And those are basically to preserve, like you said, for flavor, because fermented foods have amazing layers of flavor in them.
Mm-hmm.
Health benefits, which I think is a big one for a lot of people, myself included, it's all these good probiotics that, like, I didn't grow up eating fermented foods unless it was cheese and chocolate. So this whole other range of different kinds of fermented gut bacteria that we're helping to create a more, you know, a more sustainable interior sort of environment also. Mm-hmm. And those are the big three reasons. I've talked a lot about the fourth reason that I give, which is food justice, supporting our community through food.
Tell us about that. How do you relate fermentation to food justice? I'd love to hear what you say.
Well, I think in a couple different ways, on a bigger scale and a smaller scale, like, I think supporting a local food economy is food justice, like creating a more sustainable network of small local farms and being able to support those farms more during the season, creating products that help the, you know, even farmers. Like, I've taught workshops to help farmers sort of expand the number of products that they have so that they have a more balanced season, so it's not all peak during the summer and then flat. They can sort of level it out a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But also helping people to learn a way to preserve food and take more control of their own food system. So on an individual level, like, make healthier food to put in their bodies. You know, you can get amazing kimchi at, you know, at Korean groceries, but if it's mass produced, I would say 90% of it has MSG in it. So if you don't want that, you know, if you don't want to put that in your body, then I can teach you how to make kimchi that's amazingly delicious and doesn't have MSG.
And I'm looking at your website and I see these kimchi dumplings and I wish you were here with them for me. They look really, really delicious. And I think you were getting to number five, the fifth reason.
So number five, and kimchi is a good segue, is, like, this could be part of your cultural heritage. There are, every country that exists in the world has some kind of fermentation in it. And, you know, if you're from Korea, it may be kimchi. Like, that may be part of your traditional, your family tradition, like, you make kimchi. If you're from Eastern Europe, it might be sauerkraut. If you're from Latin America, it could be cortito. You know, if you have grandparents on the Lower East Side, like, you might have grown up with half sour and full sour cucumbers. Like, we you know, if you come from, like, a strong cultural background, you may have fermentation as part of your history. And if you don't, like, I kind of grew up, I call myself a mutt. Like, I have all kinds of different cultural backgrounds and didn't necessarily grow up with strong fermentation, like I mentioned earlier, in my history, but can explore those other strong cultural traditions that are out there.
I love that through this craft, you can, or art, craft, food, science, you can both connect with, like, this deep heritage, this deep historical heritage, but you can also play. And you talked about the fact that you can really be very creative with the products that you're making. And I'm just wondering if you can tell us about, I don't know, something that you were experimenting with recently that seemed a little out there, but worked for you.
Well, I can tell you one of the favorite products that I created last season is a kraut that I call a wild chick kraut.
Wild chick.
Wild chick. And I kind of did it in response to the sunchoke ramp kraut that I make, which is amazingly delicious. And because it uses ramps, which are very, very popular, and also almost so popular they're in danger of being over-harvested, mm-hmm. That I like to be really intentional on many different levels about the products that I'm creating. So I do a small, small batch of the ramp kraut, and I wanted to find a plant that is abundant, basically. And through some herbal medicine coursework and research that I've done, I came across this plant, chickweed, that is a weed, and it is a delicious weed.
And it is very abundant.
It is very abundant. It is incredibly abundant.
Ask your organic farmer. He will tell you. She will tell you.
Totally.
It's abundant. Oh, wow. They must be so thrilled that you're using it.
Yeah. So I'm like asking farmers to harvest weeds for me so that I can make products.
That is awesome.
Yeah. It's great fun. It's a fun place to play.
So for those of you who want to play with Michaela, you go to her website, crockandjar.com. There are all kinds of classes, and you can find out information about the meetup as well. Join us at the Just Food Conference, April 5th, and do a deep dive into fermentation with Michaela. And then we have 1 second left. Michaela, you have something exciting coming up. Do you want to mention that really briefly?
Yeah, I'm actually going to Indianapolis the end of April to teach a fermentation workshop, and then we're going to be doing a fermentation dinner. There's a restaurant out there called Black Market in Indianapolis, and the owner and I have been working together on this class dinner combo, so I'm really excited about that.
That sounds delicious. So listeners out in the Midwest, make your way over there. Maybe we'll, it sounds too good to miss, but maybe we can get you to do something like that here closer to home in New York City too.
Yeah.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much, Michaela, for coming on. And thank you so much, Evan, for engineering today's show. Hopefully their stories will help you to create your own Just Food story. You can always find archived episodes on Just Food Stories on heritageradionetwork.org or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And remember, if you have any questions for the program, you can call in live at 718-497-2128 or email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. See you next week, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.